Blog Talk Radio.
August 2010 at 8 p.m. and the Hermetic Hour is on the air. Now tonight we're having a discussion on the dark side of Hermetic magic. We will explore the works of the 20th century's most erudite and accomplished diabolist, Kenneth Grant, and his Typhonian Gnosis. We'll trace his sources through Crowley and the occult artist Austin Osman Spare. And then we'll look back at the fin de siècle, the decadence of the late 19th century. And we'll touch on Kenneth Grant's adoption of the Cthulhu mythos of fantasy writer H.P. Lovecraft and his fictional Necronomicon. We'll read some deliciously evil snippets from Grant's books. And then, finally, we will present our own lovingly crafted satire, Beyond the Nostrils of Newit, which is from the forthcoming Seventh Ray. As I said, this really ought to be our Halloween show. And so let's get started by just defining just who all these people are and what they've done and what they're famous and infamous for. Before we get started on that, I want to say this. I very, very much enjoy and admire and respect the work of Maestro Kenneth Grant. I think he really is one of the most erudite and accomplished diabolists, but he's also one of the most erudite and accomplished magicians of the 20th century. In my opinion, he ranks right there with Barden and certainly with Crowley. And I have a profound respect for him and his work. I think it's his work is very, very powerful and meaningful. And I believe even if you're not on the dark side, you can benefit as a Hermetic student. You can benefit from studying Kenneth Grant. Now that said, we'll get on into it. Kenneth Grant is right now 86 years old and going strong. He knew Crowley, and he knew him personally. When Crowley died, Kenneth Grant, some people say he presumed to take over the Ordo Templi Orientis, I think that Crowley certainly would have given him some kind of a charter if he had asked him for it. So what Kenneth Grant did, he established himself as the head of the OTO in England and began his work based upon Crowley's receiving IWAS, the supernatural contact that Crowley made with IWAS in the Book of the Law, the delivered work. Kenneth Grant is a very creative and a very innovative and a very creative and a very dynamic magician. And this is perhaps the main reason why he is not, he finally had to give up the idea that he was the head of the OTO, because the OTO, he's too big for the OTO. In other words, he's too creative. The people that managed to wrestle around and take over the OTO, they don't really want to be, they want to continue with Crowley. They don't want to extrapolate from Crowley. They don't want to keep developing. They kind of want to keep Crowley's work pretty much the way it is. And I will make an exception in the case of Juan Duquette, who I think is very, very creative in his own way. But other than that, the OTO seems to want to just remain with Crowley the way Crowley's work was at the time of his death. What Kenneth Grant did was, being a visionary magician, very visionary magician, he took off and made his own supernatural contacts and continued with what is generally known as the 93 current. In other words, the Iwas 93 current, the Aeon of Horus. You know, we discussed Crowley last week. This is this telemic current, which has a kind of a ruthless, I won't say evil, but let's just say a ruthless, compassionless, very hard-edged side to it. It's not something, if you are a compassionate and a loving soul, it's really not something that would attract you. It's very strong stuff. And yet, on the other hand, Crowley was not really strictly what you'd call a gothic type dark sider. He wasn't really that much of a Satanist, and in fact, Crowley's magic was just as much of the light and just as much of the daytime as it was of the twilight and of the darkness, ruthless as it was and whatever. Whereas with Kenneth Grant is a nighttime magician. He's not that solar oriented. Kenneth Grant was more oriented toward what he calls the trans-Plutonian gnosis. What I mean by that, if you can't figure that out, is that it's beyond Pluto. It's going out to the stars, so this is a nighttime kind of a thing, and Kenneth Grant's magic, it has this gothic flavor to it. It partakes, as I said in the abstract, it partakes of the Vindicek, the decadence of the late 19th century, Bollier and Huysmans and the artwork of Aubrey Beardsley and whatever. Of course, that gets into Austin Spare. So Grant is going on ahead and making these contacts, similar to the way that some of the people in the Golden Dawn after Mathers died, and even before Mathers died, they were out trying to get in contact with the secret chiefs. Well, this is what Grant, this was his approach, to make the contacts of the trans-Plutonian gnosis, to get out there, reach out to the stars, and contact these extraterrestrial entities. And he believes, and those who follow him believe, that they've had some success with this. And I wouldn't be surprised if they have. Actually, let's, right now, because I mentioned Aubrey Beardsley, let's get into Austin Spare a little bit here. Austin Osmond Spare was a graphic artist, wonderful graphic artist, by the way, very facile draftsman. He was a good, great draftsman. And he was contemporary with Crowley, and he was not very, very literate, but deeply intuitively intelligent, and had this marvelous gift for expressing himself. He was a surrealist, and he was much influenced by and he worked in the manner of William Blake. And I'm sure most of you remember that William Blake was one of the great mystics of the 1700s. And in fact, William Blake, some people say William Blake invented the comic book, which is pretty true, actually, he did. And he ran them off on his own printing press. And William Blake created his own mythology, which is very kind of biblical, and Spare did very much the same thing. He was very much influenced by William Blake, and yet Blake, you couldn't call Blake a surrealist, because Blake didn't distort his figures and didn't do the sort of thing that an actual surrealist will do, which Spare certainly did. But Spare's artwork is tremendously evocative because it is so very, very well done. Wonderful draftsman. It's the kind of thing that Crowley tried to do, but Crowley was a terrible draftsman and never could, his artwork never could come up to Spare's. But Spare was a dark side mystic, and very much into the grotesque, and into the mysterious, the sinister, and the grotesque. And his grotesqueries are marvelously ingenious and evocative. And Spare, you could say in a way that Spare was kind of the inspiration for the whole school of chaos magic. I think a lot of that comes from Spare. And, of course, Crowley used Spare's artwork sparingly in the Equinox, but Grant was, and his wife, Steffi, who is an artist, and she owes a great deal of Spare. They just really resonated with Austin Spare very, very much. Now, to give you an idea, Spare believed in getting magic down and in reducing it down to its essence. He would get it down. He said, "Okay, we'll just get to it. As long as we have our own Kabbalah, our own personal Kabbalah, we'll just get this thing right down to its essence. We'll write out a formula, and then we'll get rid of everything except the key letters, and then we'll put it all together, and then we'll get this thing down and make it as simple as possible, and then we'll throw as much emotion into it as we can." Now you can see, of course, where this is going. Well, Spare was always poor, and he was always, he never was very successful, good as he was as an artist. Francis King tells the story on Spare, whether this is true or not, but Francis King tells the story anyway. King visits Spare down in his basement flat, and Spare is sitting there at this table, and over the table is a pipe suspended from a couple of wires, this sewage pipe overhead, and Spare is going to demonstrate his form of magic. So he has this little talisman that he's worked up for roses, and he puts the talisman down on the table, and then he starts saying over and over and over and over again, "Roses, roses, 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 roses," and the pipe starts to shake, and the pipe breaks, and of course instead of roses, he gets something else dumped on it. So that was the story King told on Spear and his demonstration of a magical operation. Well, anyway, you can see that this does have some influence on the school of chaos magic. I don't know very much about chaos magic, to tell you the truth. I don't use it, so and it doesn't interest me that much, but I do understand that Spear was one of the inspirations. Well, he certainly was an inspiration for Grant, and Grant uses his artwork. Grant has, by the way, Kenneth Grant has out now 9 books, and these books, I just find them just delightful. I really enjoy it. Some of them are so expensive now that they're prohibitive. Yes, it's a series of 9 books, and they are the Typhonian trilogies. He developed the idea of Set Typhon as being the hidden god behind Crowley's Iwas and behind Crowley's Egyptian contacts that Crowley had made. In fact, he wrote one of his books is called Aleister Crowley and the Hidden God. So Kenneth Grant has this idea that Typhon, Set Typhon, is somewhat satanic, you might say, which makes me wonder how much Aquino, Mike Aquino, owes to Kenneth Grant, the Temple of Set. I don't know. I haven't really dug into Mike Aquino's material that much, so I don't, but I would imagine that there's an influence there. So anyway, so Grant digs into Set, Typhon, Sutek, and the dark side of Egyptian occultism and takes that out beyond Pluto and brings it in as a starry Gnosis and with a new Aeon and the whole procedure. Now he does this in a series of 9 books, all of which are beautifully written and I might say also beautifully published. And Grant writes, the best way to describe Grant's style is if you've read Robert Graves' The White Goddess, I think most of us have. That's the Thinking Witch's book, by the way. If you've read Robert Graves' The White Goddess, Grant writes the same way. He makes poetic connections. He stretches for gematria. He really stretches for it, but it's all right. You don't mind. You don't mind him making these associations and these strings of associations because this is magical thinking, and Graves does it. Graves does it in The White Goddess, and Graves gets away with it because he does it so well. And the same thing with Grant. Grant's not trying to be a scholar. He's trying to be a poetic, romantic magician. And he's using all the armamentarium of a magician, and he's very successful at it. Now, one of the things that with Grant that I just really, really love is that back during the 1950s and 60s, he had an organization called the New Isis Lodge, and this was his study and experimental magic group. Now, in his books, in his 9 books, he recounts various operations, experimental operations that the New Isis Lodge undertook. And they are, I'm sure that he has romanticized them greatly. In fact, some of these operations, you really have to... you have to grant him a lot of romantic license if you're going to accept that anything like this ever happened at all. But they're just delightful to read, and I would give you an idea of how they go. I would like to read one of them for you. There's one particular one that I would like to read first. is one that involves a magic mirror, because, of course, you know, we like magic mirrors, and so consequently, this is one that involves the use of a magic mirror. And this is supposedly now we're supposed to be we're getting the recounting here of a of an operation that that Kenneth says actually took place, and who are we to doubt the maestro? So here we go. Let's see. I say here we go, but I've got to juggle my phone here and the book at the same time, so let me get to there. Here we are. All right. Now, at about this period, a woman named Mira joined the lodge. This is from Hakati's Fountain, by the way. She was immediately drawn to the relic, although she had no more knowledge of its recent associations than we had of its ancient ones. She did suggest, however, that we might use it to inform the basis of a rite designed to explore its magical history. The lodge room was therefore furnished, as far as possible, to accord with the period of the relevant dynasty, and the officiating priestess was an accomplished ritualist. Mira herself was a natural sensitive and had several times demonstrated her peculiar powers. Attired in appropriate robes, she was seated before a magic mirror set at an oblique angle against the mummy casing so that two distinct images of it appeared simultaneously, one above the other. Lutes and pipes lent a lulling atmosphere to the proceedings, and it was not long before Mira's eyes assumed a void and distant expression. It is usual in such circumstances for the scryer alone to see the images in the magic mirror. On this occasion, however, the officiating priestess, seven acolytes, and the visiting priest from one of Gerald Gardner's covens saw the fading out of the reflected image and the abrupt introduction of animated entities enacting the following drama in the depths of the glass. A long object was wheeled by black-cowled figures into a tunnel which seemed to recede to infinity. It resembled a mobile divan, and upon it a woman, dazzlingly white, reclined upon cheetah pelts, dangling paws and tails identified the latter. But there were additional attributes which were not physical, although they appeared in the reflection as substantially as those that were. They may have been ectoplasmic extrusions of the woman's past karmas. They coiled in drifts like interstellar dust, mushrooming and snowing down a luminous powder. On the tunnel walls where they formed curious deposits, and while Mira finally surfaced, she described them as a sort of fantastic fungus, and it covered the walls like a green moss imbued with malignant life, which swarmed over any surface that presented itself. And these were many because Mira's angle of vision continually shifted, so that new surfaces were exposed to view, and the white woman on the trolley seemed to change color as a fungoidal tentacle reached out from the wall and explored her body. She resembled a bladder of transparent flesh, inflated alternately with the vaporous of green scarlet mauve, and finally with an indigo-tinted fluid. And the object of the performance remained obscure. No one could fathom the purpose of such colorful organisms, for thus they appeared to be, judging by the expression of rapture on the face. I think I was supposed to say orgasms here. Rapture on the face of the recumbent priest. Christus. Yes, this is really, really very, very heady stuff. Now, he had several, he recounts several of these adventures in the New Isis Lodge. One of them, I remember, they lowered a poor priestess named Clanda down a well, and she was eaten, you know, or she was eaten alive or something or other by some creature at the bottom of the well. And then Crowley's voice came in from the bottom of the well, and yeah, that sort of thing is just you wonder how they managed to keep it going. But the one that I am really fascinated by, and the one that I want to read to you is the one where they developed the Lovecraftian this Lovecraftian setting based upon the temple upon the plain of Lang, which was in a Lovecraft story, which they set in the Arctic. So I won't read it. I'll just describe it to you. They get up the whole lodge room in white, so it would resemble a snowfield, and they had a white altar. And they dressed the priestess in a black silken sheath, and they put her out on an ice ball, what was sort of like an iceberg. And then they lowered a mechanical owl down and to tear off the owl was supposed to come down and tear off her little silken outfit. But then while this was going on, they somehow or other managed to bring up these white slugs from below, and the slugs began to crawl up over her and under her garments and whatever. And this finally culminated in her being ravished by the slugs, but she rather enjoyed it anyway. This sort of thing is beautifully written and marvelously romantic. Couldn't possibly do it, but I have no doubt, however, that Kenneth did practice magic, obviously, but perhaps not quite so fantastically. One of the things that we need to get into now, of course, is Howard Phillips Lovecraft, because there's a sort of a two-way thing going on here with Lovecraft in the occult or in the present-day magical community. And I want to make it clear that Grant's use of Lovecraft, I think the way Grant uses Lovecraft is justifiable, and I think it's he uses it in a sophisticated manner, and I'm for what he does. Although I'm not a follower of Grant, but if I was a follower of Grant, I would certainly not mind him using it this way. And the reason is this. Lovecraft was not an occultist. He was a science fiction horror story writer, and he had a wonderful dark imagination. He sort of inherited the mantle of Edgar Allan Poe, and he wrote back in the 1920s and 1930s, as most of you are aware. Anyway, Lovecraft did not, except when he had to for a story. He didn't research deeply into the occult. He was not that interested in it, and he was actually, like my friend Richard Shaver, he was a total materialist. And yet, he was a total materialist as far as his philosophy was concerned, but his imagination was something else again entirely. Now, Lovecraft, and this is where the supernatural aspect of it comes in, Lovecraft was a true dreamer. And Lovecraft had that unique ability to have vivid, consistent, although fantastic, dreams that were consistent enough to where he could make stories out of them. And most people don't have this. Most people's dreams are so disjointed that they couldn't really, you know, they might get a little idea once in a while for a story. But Lovecraft had the unique ability to where his dreams were more consistent. He could actually make stories out of them. So this is where he got a lot of his ideas. And, of course, also he got his ideas from other writers. He was a great, Lovecraft was a great admirer and a fan of Lord Dunsany. And most people that read Lovecraft don't realize that Lovecraft had a whole series of stories, the Carter stories, the Dream Cycle of Unknown Kadath. These are wonderful fantasies, and they are actually, as far as I'm concerned, they're superior to Dunsany. They're in the manner of Dunsany. They're inspired by Dunsany, but superior to Dunsany. Dunsany was an awkward stylist. Lovecraft was a marvelous stylist. And so those of you who have just been reading Lovecraft's dark horror stuff, try the dream cycle. You really, this is beautiful, beautiful material. Anyway, Lovecraft was a dreamer. Now that's where the supernatural aspect of it comes in. Now Lovecraft, he dreamed and imagined an elder race of dark, sinister gods that non-human, who preceded the human race, were somehow or other driven out of the off the planet, and or at least driven into another dimension. And they still exist in this other dimension, and they want to come back and take over the planet again. And of course, naturally, if they do that, they're going to chow down on all the rest of us. I mean, these entities of Lovecraft don't like people. This is the part about Lovecraft that's difficult to gather in why magicians would be so attracted to entities that are so completely anti-human. And yet, because of some strange quality in human beings, human beings yearn for, I guess in a sense, yearn for destruction. I mean, as long as it is a weird, wild, and strange, let's go out with a Nash or something like that. I don't know. I don't understand it myself. But I know that when I was a kid, I just beat up Lovecraft. I loved Lovecraft. So I guess maybe we've all got a little bit of that in us, this fascination with something horrible that is much more powerful than we are. And this is one of the things with Grant. But Grant handles it, I think, as well as can be for that sort of an orientation, because Grant says, and we have to agree with him, that, well, yeah, these extraterrestrial alien or extra-dimensional alien creatures are very, very powerful and are very different, and so we're afraid of them. And we fear them, but we really shouldn't fear them because they're different. Now that's an acceptable way to look at it. Except that I would counter that by saying, well, yes, but you can have spiritual contacts with extraterrestrial, with angelic beings that are wonderful, that fill you with light, that fill you with love, that give you this wonderful experience. So, and they're different, and they're not human. So why are we so completely interested in the dark side? That's where I'm coming from. So, and yet on the other hand, I will. We're talking here about the dark side of the Force now, so we'll give Darth Vader his due. Now, anyway, to get back to Lovecraft, though. So Lovecraft comes up with this, what's called the Cthulhu mythos. Now, Cthulhu was one of the, of course, there's several different ways to pronounce Cthulhu, but most everybody says Cthulhu. And Cthulhu was a water god. He was a water god that also had wings. He was a bat-winged, octopus-headed water god, and lived down in the in a ruined city down on, under the Pacific. And Cthulhu was perhaps the most terrifying and the worst of Lovecraft's creations. So his elder gods and his and these elder demons out there in this other dimension are referred to as the Cthulhu mythos. Now, Lovecraft created this, used these in a series of stories, and then he created, in order to enhance his stories, he created a fake grimoire. In other words, he invented a grimoire based to some extent on Picatrix and to some extent on Dean Kelly's Enochian. But he called this the Necronomicon, the Book of Dead Names. And he even attributed the English translation to Dee himself. But the Necronomicon was a fictional work. There never was a Necronomicon. This is something Lovecraft came up with to use in his stories. And yet, because of this fascination that disempowered teenagers like myself when I was there and other people and people who just seem to have this dark side thing. They want a Necronomicon so badly that there have been at least seven hoaxes. And the most successful of these hoaxes was done some years back by a fellow writer named Peter Lavenda, who wrote under the name of Simon and came out with this leather-bound, and then, of course, it became a big paperback seller. But originally it was leather-bound, silver-stamped, highly advertised book. And what Lavenda did with this thing is he got some Assyrian Akkadian demonology texts that had been, I think they were French, they hadn't been published in English, hadn't been translated into English. So he got these and he put them together, and this was essentially Assyrian Akkadian demonology. And so it didn't have anything much to do with Lovecraft, but it was demonology, and it was old, and it came from the same part of the world, because Lovecraft was supposed to, Lovecraft said that Abdul al-Hazred had, the mad Arab in the 9th century had done this thing, and that, of course, the 9th century is when the Picatrix was done by another mad Arab, so that's probably where he got the idea. But the thing was that this Necronomicon that Lavenda came up with, he had a graphic artist do his sigils for him. I talked to the graphic artist at one point. And the guy said, well, he said, I don't know how to do a sigil. He said, I just looked at a bunch of magic books and put them together. And these things were a mixture of Kameas and automatic writing and symmetricals and everything else all jammed together. They couldn't possibly work. But the problem with this thing was it took off, and people were having all kinds of experiences with this book. And they were basically because it was actual Assyrian Akkadian demonology, and there was no way to control it. And I've heard some real horror stories about this book. So it is. That particular so-called Necronomicon is kind of a dangerous thing to have around. We have I don't know whether Mike's totally listening tonight, but Mike got started as a teenager with that Necronomicon. And he then, when he realized it was not really the Necronomicon, but he was so interested in it, he went ahead and became an expert and a very, very competent magician in Assyrian Akkadian demonology from that. Anyway, Grant adopted Lovecraft's actual, you know, his actual Necronomicon that he had dreamed, that he, his Cthulhu mythos, not the stuff in Lavenda's book, but the Cthulhu mythos, and Grant accepted it as a literary inspiration that had its own validity. Now, in this sense, Grant is justified, because this thing has, it has a power, a dark power, that has given it some kind of a magical validity. And so Grant has employed it. But he's employed it carefully with that idea in mind. And so in that sense, I think that's a valid use of Lovecraft's material. Grant is definitely a hermetic master, and one of the ways that you can be sure of that, you can be absolutely sure of that, is that Grant has reached a point where he can create his own elementaries, to use Barden's term, and send them out there into outer space to colonize the planets of other stars. And only a hermetic master can do this. And so, and I know that sounds absolutely fantastic, but if you follow the teachings of Hermes, you know that this sort of thing actually is within the province of the magician. Now, for instance, let me see if I read something here in the mob zone. I'm having trouble juggling some of this stuff here. Let's see here. A highly effective method of stellar magic involves the sixth power zone. The fine particles of sand-like substance contained in this chakra are permeated by the fire snake's magnetic emanations. By magnetizing the chakra with this energy, the snake is stirred and it flames up from Muladhara. Metallic discs are placed upon the intervening power zones for the collection of ohas emitted by the fire snake on its return to the base at Muladhara. The ohas is subsequently preserved in steel and containers, later used in a rite of succubation in which it is blended with the colors of the Shakti. In due course is born a being that is adapted perfectly to existence on a chosen star. Being a non-human child, its gestation, birth, and maturation occur in a period of time, which is, by terrestrial standards, fleeting. The stellar anatomy of a subtle body in man consists in marmas, or cross currents of energy which appear to clairvoyant perception as a network of magnetic vectors, star waves, and lunar lattices common to cosmic power zones throughout the solar system. Now, this, as I said, is very, 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 very advanced. And so what we have here is the master literally creating his own universe. And I know to some people who are not deeply into hermetic magic, this may sound too far out to give any ho-ho, but if you really understand hermetic philosophy and you realize man is, you will understand that this, whether or not he has the power to do it in your universe, he certainly has the power to do it in his. Now, one thing about Kenneth Grant that turns some people off, and I don't quite agree with him, but he is very, very much a sex magician. I don't know at 86 whether he still is or not, but he certainly, you know, is a proponent of it. And he took, you know, the OTO's ninth degree. They said they got it from Carl Kilner and he got it from the Tantrics. Well, that's probably not true. They probably got it from P.B. Randolph, the American black sex magician, and that certainly wasn't That was more Western, and it involves the actual Daitri method is alchemical. It's not tantric, and you go right straight to orgasm, and then use the fluid to impregnate the talisman. So that's Western sex magic, and had not very much to do with Eastern sex magic. So Grant actually became an expert in Eastern sex magic, which is coitus interruptus, which, in other words, you go for 44 minutes without doing anything, and then transmute that energy into transmute it and transform it into a higher energy. And so Grant's explored this whole range, and he has become a consummate scholar in Sanskrit and everything. I mean, I thought, you know, I knew something about this. Sometimes I can't follow him. He has me heading for the Sanskrit dictionary, reading his books. You know, he really has dug into it. And one of the things that turns some people off in Grant's material is he continually refers to all of these sexual, mechanical sexual aspects, like the 14 different secretions of the female, and he goes on and on and on about these colors, and to the point where the sexual aspect of it, unless you're very interested in that, it gets to be a little hard to take. So that's one of the things. Now, personally, I have nothing against Western sex magic, and it's great, but I just don't think it should be that mechanical. I think Western sex magic needs to be romantic, and it needs to be glamorous. And I think that if you start making it as technical as the OTO does, as Crowley did, and as Grant did, I think you destroy the romance of it. And the romance of it is what gives it its magical power. So personally, I think this is my personal feeling, I think it's more important to charge it with desire more so than have all of these little mechanical things that go on that make it too clinical. Now, what we did, and I promised I'd do this in this show. We got in the next seventh ray coming up. We did a satire. What we like to do in seventh ray, we do book review. We do satirical book reviews, and we did one on Nazi bimbos and the story of Siegfried. And we create these silly books and we review them. Well, what we did was we created a silly book, in the manner of Kenneth, and what we did was we took everything that would be below the waist, everything that would be down would be down in the genital area, and we moved it all up to the nose. And in doing this, what we've done is we've created something that gives you the essence of Kenneth Grant without having to get down there and, you know, in that. So, but I have to say this, that this, you can't do a thing like this unless you really like the person you're satiring and you really enjoy their work. So consequently, understand that this is in a way is a compliment to the maestro, but it enables you to get the grand experience without having to have all the technical sexual stuff. All right, here it is. Seventh Ray Special Advanced Book Review, Beyond the Nostrils of Nuit by Snort and Grunt, and it's illustrated by his wife Snuffy Grunt. And I got an Austin Spare type illustration here that's worth the price of admission, frankly. Now, this third volume of the Sniffonian trilogy focuses on the revival of nasal magic and the cult of the dark nostril. Snartengrat worms his inquisitive finger deep into the ancient astronasal lore, expectorating the hidden mysteries of the Kabbalistic macroproboscis doctrine. He relates this arcana to two recently discovered black holes in the constellation Virgo. He dubs these dark vortices the nostrils of Nuit, and they form a cosmic analog to the earthly sinuses of Set, as described in his Volume 2, Modern Mucus Magic. Now, he describes in detail the forbidden rites of nasal necromancy, that's eating the boogers of the dead, as set forth in the fabled Nostronomicon of Abdrul al-Nosebleed. Now, the relation of sun and moon mucus to the tantric nadis is examined. Inducing nasal hemorrhages to charge phoenix talismans is discussed, and we are warned that dark nostril adepts explore the undersides of desks and tables, searching for the nasal incrustations of unsuspecting victims. This is the dark side of West Indian snotteria, a form of black magic in which the Bugarero, or the Bugarima, female, binds the nasal incrustations of the intended victim, scries along the astral mucus matrix, connecting his or her militant consciousness to the victim's nasal passages, thus creating a fatal condition of post-nasal drip. And while visiting these dark islands, tourists, especially those with deviated septums, are cautioned not to blow their noses on Kleenex and then discard them. Mucus and bloodstained hankies are considered an essential item in the magical cauldron of the Bugarero. Along this line, visitors to Eastern Europe are cautioned to beware of the dreaded Nosferatu, evil spirits who transform themselves into gnats. And fly up the nostrils of their victims. The ancient philosophy underlying Grantsniffonian mythology is that of Gnosticism. He often cites the writings of the German apologist Dr. Gesundheit, especially following descriptions of spontaneous nasal revelations. Blowing one's nose is a conscious, magical act, whereas the spontaneous sneeze is a mystical experience, according to Grant. Grant makes it clear that the notorious 14th degree of nasal magic is not necessarily a homo-nasal procedure. It simply involves direct mouth-to-nose sacramental suction rather than the indirect mouth-to-mouth exchange in the more widely practiced 13th degree, that's heteronasal technique, similar to swapping chewing gum among the uninitiated. He reinterprets traditional magical images to conform with his Snaphonian mythos. The often used sign of silence or sign of Hippocrates is not seen as a sealing of the lips in this case, but as the Eucharistic consumption of the sacred booger. The mysterious snotrains of Nostradamus provide Grant with further proofs of his uninhibited Snaphonian exegesis. In the air of the snuffle will be a great scuffle when Jupiter sneezes and hell over freezes. We'll do as we please us by Jesus. We are treated to one of Grant's exciting accounts of a disastrous magical operation wherein his new sinus lodge hosted the banana slug called from Oregon, and the banana slug, the Aleomorix colombianus, is the state animal of Oregon, and it's bright yellow, slimy-skinned mollusk with an extremely long nose. Now, the slug's proboscis is huge in proportion to the animal and is waved about in a courtship dance. And once two slugs are connected, the poor creatures must chew off each other's noses to separate. The Oregon cult members initiated the reproductive rites of their totem creature with such enthusiasm that only three of them, having vegetarians for partners, managed to survive. Now, although some may find Grunt's writing style congested, to most it's not, and in his final volume of their Snaphonian trilogy, Snorton and Snuffy Grunt have exceeded our expectations. Take it from one who knows, this is one to pick. And with that, I think we'll get out of here before The Nosferatu come after us. Anyway, next week we'll go to we'll explore the magic of Frederick Adams and the artwork of Frederick Adams, and that'll be a good contrast to Kenneth Grant. So be sure and tune in, and we'll take some call-ins next week, and hopefully Joe Carson will call in on Fred Adams. So we'll see you then, and good magic.